not from devotee, just normal.
Anyone, just, yeah.
It's such like in the correct environment, there are some problems now in China, such as...
With the government?
Environment.
Oh, the environment.
Environment, oh. Yeah. It's like food in security, drugs and the unsafe, and they want to know if in that environment, how they to keep honest.
And what environment? I didn't understand. The
unsafe environment. Maybe food and have problem and drugs.
Yeah. And people tell lies.
People tell lies. There's drugs and food
yes.
problems.
I see. Well, you know, this time, when I speak at these times, I'm speaking from a philosophical point of view, and from the position that Krishna is the solution to everything. When I sit in this chair and before this deity and the Guru Varga, I'm speaking from that perspective. So this is, you have to understand that. Otherwise, you won't understand why I am saying these things. So, it has to deal with understanding the nature of the world. All you're really describing there is the world. The way of the world. That's the way the world is, always. It's not that it's China or India or Thailand, America. This is the world. A famous book in the English literature is called The Way of the World. I believe it was written by William Congreve. That's the title of his book, or play. And Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he also said once in one of his talks that what is troubling us at present, what is that thing that's giving us trouble at present? It's what we call the world. Right? It's the world. It's life. And these things are always there. Right? Lying, cheating, that's just the so-called way of the world. It's always been that way, it is that way at present, and it will always be that way because we're living in the world of exploitation. We touched upon this the last time we spoke. In the world of exploitation, in the language of the Bhagavatam, it says, jivo jiva shijivanam. One living being is living by exploiting another. That's the mundane truth. The law of the mundane world. If you express it in Darwinian language, it's survival of the fittest. Right? And it's cruel and unfair. But that is the way of the world. So, rather than trying to find some way to live in the world of exploitation, harmoniously or happily, when someone realizes that this is what the world is, or in the language of Srila Prabhupada in his Bhagavad Gita purport, he says, when someone understands that the material world is a constant source of perplexity at every step, it's a constant source of perplexity at every step, saying, such a person should approach Guru. And try and get out of this world. Try and leave the world of exploitation and go further than merely renunciation and enter the land of dedication. Because one approach to this is saying, oh, since the world is this way, it's so unfair, it's so cruel, it's so full of faults, flaws, injustice, so renounce that world. Just renounce everything. Don't be involved in it on any level. That's half true. It's based upon, you know, Gyaninas Tattvadarshi. There's the word again. Tattvadarshi, Drishi. Those who are seeing, experiencing the truth. Right? It's not told that they create truth. They don't create a political system, a social system, a financial system, a better way of exploitation, a more fair way of exploiting. That is not the solution. Right? Or to exploit people very nicely. Right? Exploit them in a way that they're happy to be exploited. That is not the answer. Tattvadarshi, those who have seen the truth, have experienced something superior to the path of exploitation as a means of fulfillment. And what that can be summed up as the notion that by acquiring, controlling, and consuming, that I'll find fulfillment. Through consumption, through consumerism, the acquisition, control, and consumption of objects. I being a subject, living in the objective world, that some reconfiguration of the objective world, which is based on exploitation, I'll find harmony in my life, I'll find peace, happiness, etc. Or through gyan, knowledge, through education, we will eradicate ignorance and bad tendencies. When television was introduced in America, they said that with this TV, there will be the end of ignorance. You can now watch this on YouTube. You can see when they're introducing television, they say, well, what will we do with this magical box and device? You know, and they're saying, with this, everyone will have one of these in their house, and ignorance will be eradicated. Everyone will be educated, and when through the acquisition of knowledge, all these bad tendencies toward lying, cheating, stealing, etc., will be eliminated because everyone will be enlightened. So TV, the distribution of television, will result in the enlightenment of the citizenry. Right? And it's ironic that years later, the TV, one of the nicknames for TV in America was the boob tube, and which means boob in this sense, it means an idiot. Right. So this box that was supposed to enlighten the citizens who live in the democracy, because the basic principle of the democracy is that an enlightened citizenry will, you know the rest. So the enlightened citizenry was not the effects of this television. So now the idea is shifted from that. The French have a saying, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more things change, the more they remain the same. So now, what's the new idea? Is through, you know, the, I forget exactly how they express their slogan, but Google slogan is something like, organizing the world's information. It's something like that. So they say, now, through the internet, we have a database with the sum total of all human knowledge. And by having this, again, the same idea is there, that will produce an enlightened citizenry, and that enlightened citizenry will elect the right people, make the right decisions, etc. So, and from a Vedic point of view, there's five stages of knowledge called pratyaksha, paroksha, aparoksha, vadhoksaja, and aprakrita. So pratyaksha, that means, now we were talking about the word drishi before, to see. Aksha means to, sometimes means the eyes or what is seen. Pratyaksha means your direct experience. You are seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, feeling. And on the basis of that, you're making observations, conclusions of what you see, hear, taste, touch, smell, and feel. That's pratyaksha. But then you realize, oh, the person sitting next to me is also doing the same thing, and so is the other person and all the other people I know. They're also seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, feeling. So if we share that, that'll be beneficial to me because you've seen things I've not seen, etc. Right? So if we pool the information together, that'll help me, you, all of us, make better decisions, informed decisions. But if the basis of making a decision is acquiring, controlling, and consuming for fulfillment, then we're only going to use this shared information to exploit one another, to continue the exploitation, rather than to keep it to a minimum or reduce it. So anyway, pratyaksha, paroksha. Para aksha means what was not seen by me, but seen by others. So that's the idea behind Google and the internet, is to have the sum total of shared human experience, whether it's from, and it should include, everyone who lived and observed before us. So we have the inherited wisdom of all the people who lived before us, like ancient civilizations. They also had some wisdom, they have some knowledge they're handing down, so we'll include that, and then that combined with modern knowledge. And you understand the idea that we'll have this database, which is the sum total of all human knowledge, experience, observation, good, bad, and otherwise. And then by querying it, questioning it, we should get some response to our necessity. But again, what is that necessity? What is it that we're searching for? Do we think that a database will supply the answer to that search? If we're looking for something, consumer goods or other kind of things, or for people to consume, still within the realm of consumption and exploitation, then it may be helpful. But addressing what's known as inner fulfillment, it may not address that, because that's another substance is required. So for this, we have pratyaksha, paroksha, then we're told the third stage that some subscribe to, where they'll say, actually, if we can create a tabula rasa, means a clean slate, I've acquired so many prejudices, these acquired prejudices are influencing my judgment, and I have so many stereotypes about life, experience, etc. If I could cleanse myself of all of that, and start fresh, from a fresh position, tabula rasa means a clean slate. So, and just like when there's an error written on the board, I don't even know if they have boards anymore, but you know, they have a whiteboard now, or a chalk, where they write, if you write an error, you get an eraser, erase that, and say, let's start over. This is so far wrong, we need to erase that and start over. So this is one idea too, that we'll create a clean slate and start from there. And then if we can do that, then we'll be, we won't have any acquired prejudice slanting or skewing our experience and our observation of things. That's another idea. But Vaishnavism begins with, as Guru Maharaj put it, the infinite making itself known to the finite. And we say, the finite cannot know the infinite by finite means. This is the beginning of Sri Guru and His Grace, where Srila Guru Maharaj very nicely, in a very rational way, he shows the necessity for Guru and by extension, divine revelation or revealed truth. And he begins with the premise, to err is human. So that's how I will reframe your question. I'll say, sum it up, what are you saying to me? This human erring tendency, whether, and not to point the finger at others, say, they're like this, but of course we're not like that. No, to err is human, right? It is an innate human tendency, right? It all, whether you look at it from an Eastern perspective or a Western perspective, right? The tendency to degrade. So Guru Maharaj began his famous essay, Sri Guru and His Grace, with this maxim, to err is human. He said, to err is inevitable for all, for everyone, being that we're not perfect. Right? So, but, interestingly, even though that is our condition, that is our situation, he said, there is an element within us that seeks perfection. This is what is interesting. Although we acknowledge it's a universal axiomatic truth, to err is human, we know we're not perfect, everyone will acknowledge that. Still, there's something within us that is seeking perfection. So that's very interesting. And it means, in the face of so much evidence, of so much statistical analysis to the contrary, of virtual impossibility, still, we're hardwired to seek perfection. Then he makes the next point. He said, but that tendency within us towards perfection, it's small, it's weak. If it were great, we would have it at once. But we find ourselves repeatedly in a less than perfect situation, dealing with our faults and shortcomings, but still somehow hankering for perfection. So Guru Maharaj makes this point. That tendency we have is weak. So I've mentioned this before, when Salvador Dali was asked if he believed in God or not. And he's the famous surrealistic artist and, you know, sometimes madman. And they said to him, Dali, do you believe in God? And he said, yes, but I have no faith. So we can say, oh, it's a clever repartee, or I think it was also an honest, actually a very honest, candid statement that is true for most people. There's some intuitive sense about God. Now I'm equating perfection with divinity. But he said, but I have no faith. This tendency to the cultivation of faith, which is essential to come in connection with divinity substantially, is very weak. As he said, I have no faith. Therefore, we need association, Saru, Shastra, Guru, Vaishnava, in the form of scriptures, revealed truth, those who can extract from that, and demonstrate its relevance in our lives. So, Srila Guru Maharaj concludes, this makes room or points to the necessity that what will help us is outside of ourselves. That's the next point that he makes. Otherwise, if it was just within us alone, we'd have it already. We wouldn't even be having this discussion. But it's not like that. This weak tendency, we're seeking perfection, is not very strong developed. We're seeking a connection with divinity, really. As I've also mentioned in regard to, like, on speaking of the internet and databases, you have things like matchmaker.com. You understand what that is? It means where you're looking for your partner. Men are looking for women, women are looking for men. Match, you're looking for a match. One such site is called matchmaker.com. They have different names. But the idea, I mean, it could be Facebook. Facebook was created for this purpose, was its original purpose. You know, I mean, as if that's some kind of a revelation. But my point is, here, and alluding to this, is that whenever the way these things work is by the person establishes some ideal criteria, saying, I envision my soulmate, my other half, match, as, and then they put down some, what we'll call, ideal criteria. Right? Who is your ideal? And they said, my ideal will be like this, 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 and that. But here I want to introduce the idea that ideal is synonymous with the absolute. That only the absolute is capable of representing the ideal, really and truly, substantially. So when you seek an ideal and a source other than the absolute, that will necessarily end in disappointment and frustration. Because it's not you're not dealing with the absolute. So just as, you know, we talk of beauty, people have some ideal criteria of beauty. You know, as the poet said, you know, hundreds of years ago, it's true to today. Beauty is but a flower, wrinkles will devour, brightness falls from the air, queens have died young and fair. Someone wrote this poem 500 years ago. Pretty, you know, or 300 to 500 years ago. And it's still true. So ephemeral beauty. So even if we find someone who's so beautiful, then we see their beauty wither and deteriorate and become less than ideal. Once they seem to be epitomizing that ideal and personifying that ideal, and then it withers and the person becomes disappointed. And it's one example. But whenever we're taking ideal criteria and trying to impose them upon another person, place, or thing, but usually another person. And then as we interact with that person, we can maintain that illusion, infatuation, for some time until the flower withers, right? Wilts. The ideal starts to wilt, and we realize this person is less than ideal in many ways. And then the relationship, disappointment, frustration, disappointment, and disillusion. So the spiritual project is to direct these natural tendencies toward the absolute, the actual ideal. And here, by extension, it means divinity. And if we go beyond divinity in the general sense and take divinity in its highest aspect, it will lead us to Krishna conception, reality, the beautiful, Nitya Navana Mayamana, who's ever fresh, ever new, right? Whose beauty is not wilting or withering. But the same thing is there. If we remain in a position where we're going to project ourselves upon the infinite, the same thing will happen. So we're told above the paroksha plane is the adhoksaja plane. Adha-aksaja. See that word aksha again, which we said before means eyes, but in this instance, senses. So adha-aksaja means this is different. Whereas the first one, you're seeing and observing, pratyaksha. Second one, paroksha, we're sharing our observations, observe and experience. Third one, cleansed of all experience. But the adhoksaja plane means, what is it? Descends from the upper world into this plane. Descending, and what does it do? Suppresses mundane experience. Adha means to push down aksaja. It suppresses your sense experience. So what is being experienced is beyond what can be seen by the eye and the mind. That is not what the deity is. That is not beyond what can be heard by the ear and the mind. Beyond, still can be heard, still can be seen, still can be felt, still can be touched. Everything is there, but be adhoksaja, beyond mundane experience. Where do we get a hint of this possibility? Every night, when we dream, right? When we dream, there's all full central, full range, spectral range of central activities take place in dream. So it means there's a way, there's another plane, even in, and this is the lowest. We're just talking about the mind, right? And, you know, subconscious and that. In that plane, you can see, hear, taste, touch, smell, feel, have dialogue, do all kinds of things. So it's a hop, skip, and a jump from there to the plane of Atma. Why should we think that in the Atma, the soul world, there's no hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, or feeling? When it's actually Atma, the nature of Atma, to engage in different types of sensual activities. The Bhagavatam, in one of his famous examples, it's like, na, ra, ra, ja, you know, Channa, about the moon, saying that sometimes we'll see the moon is hidden, but clouds are illuminated. Right? So you'll see these shining clouds, but you can't see the moon because it's behind the clouds. But it's actually, the only reason you can see the clouds is because of the moon. This is the example the Bhagavatam is saying. The only reason you can see in my eyes, life, in my face, movements. These are the clouds. This eye, this body, mind, all, these are just clouds, subtle and gross, in front of the soul, covering it. It's in the background, shining on, it's what's bringing illumination in my eyes, your eyes, and the eyes of any living being. And what's animating them, giving them movement. So that soul, why should we conclude that only here in the mundane plane does it express itself in a personal way? By seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, and feeling, and being hardwired to seek loving relationship with other seeing, feeling, tasting, touching, smelling, hearing beings. Why? If that sort of potential possibility and tendency is not present in its original nature and position. So Srila Guru Maharaj, he introduced the conception of the subjective evolution of consciousness and something he calls chitabhas, which means chit means cognizance, cognition. So the spiritual world, sometimes called the chit world, it's made out of consciousness. Conscious, and not just consciousness, but spiritually enriched, dedicating consciousness. But so that's the chit world. This is the so-called achit jagat that's made out of these things. Right? So how is a chit subject, a spiritually conscious subject, going to navigate the achit world? It can just go and like walk around here and do stuff? No. He introduces concepts of chitabhas, chayabhas. A shadow-like representation of the soul is necessary to function in the achit jagat, the unconscious mundane world. What is the shadow-like aspect of the soul? What is the shadow-like representation? Bhumirapo anulovayu kamanubhudhirevacha ahankara ityame bina prakritirastadha. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, ego. So the mind at present, this is a shadow of the spiritual mind. The intellect at present is a shadow of the spiritual intellect. This body is a shadow of the spiritual body. The body is the biological expression of the soul's delusion. The soul expressing in a deluded state, expressing exploiting tendencies, trying to find satisfaction through exploitation, manifests, generates in cooperation with the modes of nature, karanam guna sangoasya sarasa joni janmaso, a material body, millions of them, just like the RGB on the computer monitor, right? Red, green, blue, you can make millions of variations of colors. So, the mode of ignorance, mode of passion, mode of goodness, and their various combinations make millions of varieties of life forms that are, what is it saying? Yantra Rudrani Maya. The soul is like a passenger seated on a machine of material energy. Like the Russian word machines for car, right? They always call cars machines. Yeah. So this should be even a better example. But just like a car has a driver, that's what Bhagavad Gita Krishna says, yantram, that means machine here, yantram rudrani mayaya. It's the soul driving a body made out of material energy, varieties of combination of the modes of nature. And I remember, maybe the first time I used this example was in Russia, like in 1978. Because we had just put, at the time, what is it, benzene is the fuel there? And we just put benzene in our car, and I thought, yes, just like if the car, it needs, the machine car needs benzene to run. But if the passenger thinks that that will be helpful to them, it's poison. Right? So when the soul mistakes bodily necessities and such things as that, like the fuel of the body as being, mistakes it to be the fuel of the self, then that's an unfortunate deluded condition. So what is the fuel? What is the food for the soul? Sat, we mentioned chit, right? Existence. Sat means existence. Like, this chair exists But it's not aware of its existence. I am aware of the chair's existence. So I possess not only existence, but awareness of existence. Like the old Descartesian, what is it? Cogito ergo sum, something like that. It's usually rendered as I think, therefore I am. I mean, because I'm aware of my existence, I know I exist. So that's sat and chit. But when you become aware of your existence, there's a third prospect that we become eminently aware of and endlessly fixated upon. And that is anandam. We need pleasure, happiness, love, affection, beauty, charm, sweetness. It's not enough just to exist. It's not enough to be aware of your existence. So knowledge, gyan, cannot deliver the goods. Gyan is not the food of the soul. The sat chit anandam, satyam shivam sundaram. Anandam is the food of the soul. Sundaram is the food of the soul. Ecstasy, love, beauty. That's what we're seeking for. And we're seeking for an ideal of love. People don't, maybe they do. Maybe they're so frustrated with trying to find love, they'll take anything as a consolation prize. But generally speaking, people are searching for, when they think of love, they start thinking of an ideal. Right? I mean, that's at least like the start there. Maybe later they just say, I just need a dog. Right. Or I'd have a cat, which is okay too. I don't want to get email, about, I also love cats and dogs. But you know what I mean. Or maybe you don't know what I mean. Here's what I mean. Statistically, you could make a case, like people always say, does God exist? All right, does love exist? Let's apply some of the similar criteria that they use to mount a case against the existence of God towards love. Right? We could say, love, that was something it's created by people to address the biological imperative and so that people will reproduce. But really, it's just in their minds. There's no such thing. You can't quantify it. You can't express it in a mathematical expression. You can't be sure that anyone's ever actually had that. It's just, a feeling that people have. And they use this word. Right? No one's seen it. But people say they have, but the same people who say they're madly in love, they're divorcing, 2 months later, or 2 years later, or 20 years later. And I don't want to get into that. You say, statistically, 50% of all marriages end in divorce. What have we said? Statistically, 100% of marriages end in divorce. Still, someone will think, no, this is love. Even if so many times they were disappointed and it ended in dissolution, we're so hardwired to seek love and affection, we'll believe in it despite statistical evidence to the contrary. That's the point I'm making. And believe me, I'm not arguing in favor of the non-existence of love. I'm saying that we're so hardwired for it. It must exist. But how to find it? How to connect with that? Guru Maharaj would sometimes quote that Vedic aphorism, Shrinvantu Vishe Amritasya Putra. Oh, you children, you're the nectar children. You're meant to live in the nectar world. Amritasya Putra, not the mortal world of exploitation. That's not your home. Listen to me. That means hear through anavriti shabda, anavriti shabda. Through sound, you can become liberated. Through sound, you can reawaken to your actual identity as a child in the nectar soil. The Amrita world of immortality, full knowledge, bliss, ecstasy, happiness, love, affection. And say, and Om. All the Vedic mantras, they begin with Om and end in Om. And Srila Guru Maharaj says, what does that mean? It's a big yes, saying yes, what you're searching for exists. What the heart is searching for exists. People will say, no, no, when you believe in the Romeo and Juliet story, that's for 14-year-olds. It's a Shakespeare play about two 14-year-olds. Why do you think they're 14? Because that can exist when you're 14. But when you get older, you'll understand when you get older. Right? They express that every last person will overcome this naivete, this innate hardwired tendency we have to search for and the ideal of love. We're looking for the personification of the ideal of love and affection and beauty, which by another name is Krishna. And so they're telling us he doesn't exist. Or such a thing doesn't exist. It's just, you know, for 14-year-olds. And so what you're left with is the biological imperative. Get on with it. And we've swallowed all this stuff. We think that these people are, we forget, they were just, you know, little babies themselves a few years back. Now they've become, they have big titles, and they're scientists, and they speak with synthetic voice. You know, if I had a synthetic speech generator for what I was saying, you'd be very impressed. The ultimate reality is beautiful. You know, there'd be 1,000 people here. We're idiots. Because the boob tube did not enlighten us. We're the bastard children of the Enlightenment. It didn't work. So that's the bad news. The good news is Om. What your heart is searching for existed, has existed all along, still exists. And you can connect with that through hearing. Amnaya prahatatvam haryam iha paramam sarvashaktim rasabdim. The nature of the ultimate reality from which we all come is beauty, charm, sweetness, love, and affection. But it's obvious, we're searching everywhere and anywhere, or as Gurudev would say, manywhere. Looking for love in all the wrong places, as the song said. So Gurudev said, so, children of nectar, you were born to taste nectar. You must not be satisfied with anything but nectar. The search for Sri Krishna, search for reality of the beautiful. And into a world where even lying is good. To go back to the original. Where lying, cheating, and stealing is nectar. Guru Maharaj is known as Krishna, autocrat, despot, and liar. And some devotees are like, run that by me again? The supreme truth, the ultimate reality, is an autocrat, despot, and liar. Autocrat, reality's for itself, by itself. Hegelian principle, not contingent upon any other, exists to fulfill his own purpose. Despot, if we were to check him by imposing mundane morality, human limitations, then we'll be the losers in that. Human beings should regulate, impose human restrictions and human morality of conditional existence upon the unconditional. Lord, this is foolishness. So they said, okay, autocrat, but liar? Said Nguru and said, yes, because you're not ready to hear the truth. So he's adopted the position of a liar to gradually parokshabhata vedoyam balanam anushasanam, the way you teach a child, an installment, and with a fair amount of lying. Do I have to explain that?
You can answer all the questions.
Four questions now.
Oh, yeah, well, that was question number one.
That answered all the questions.
Oh, it answered all. Oh, good. All right. Yeah, I mean, I could have done better, I admit. But just on the last thing, what?
I was going to ask a question.
All right, let me just to like tie this off, because people say, oh, Maharaj is saying that we should lie to the children. What it means by that, like if we're saying the solar system, we say the sun is fixed, not moving. And then there are these nine planets orbiting the sun. But then later, a few grades later, we say, you know that sun we said is fixed and not moving with the nine planets? Yeah. Actually, together with those nine planets, it's pivoting around the pole star. But if we say from the beginning, sun is moving, planets are moving, it's confusing. That's what we mean by not giving the full truth in the beginning and using the word lie.
Plane of consciousness, spiritual world is a plane of consciousness. The Guru has explained also, he used the word faith, that there's a plane of
consciousness. Yes, so right, that's why I said not just consciousness, but dedicating consciousness.
So how does faith relate with consciousness? Like what is faith and how does it relate with consciousness?
Yeah, well, we know that consciousness, in the general sense, is something that can be, allows its Guru Maharaj's word, I think, would be adaptability. So you can be a believer or a disbeliever. What enables disbelief is the same thing that enables belief. It's consciousness. So he likes to compare it to atmosphere. Like we have the Earth's atmosphere. Does anybody know the different? I forget. You know, there's like the stratosphere, the troposphere, the ionosphere. Who knows? You know? How does it go? There's atmosphere. What is it? The sequence?
I don't remember the sequence.
Saying there's stratosphere, troposphere, ionosphere. I forget. Anyway, you get the idea. There's. So he's saying air only goes up so far. At a certain point, there's no longer air.
Beyond
biosphere.
Yeah.
Neosphere.
Neosphere.
As you prefer. Yeah, it doesn't matter. We're just saying. We all know. There's like I mean, all you have to do is get on an airplane. You know, you go up, or walk up to that mountain where we live by. There's less air as you go higher till there's no air, etc. So Guru Maharaj will say, so how can you reach these other planets through ether? And in this sense, we could say for like people who were sticklers for information, like ether in the older sense of the word as this substance that was pervading everything. So he means to say that the mind, that's like an atmosphere, and by comparison, and these things, intellect would be another one. So the mind can go so far, the intellect can go so far, but to reach the spiritual plane, you need faith. And faith, as we've heard from him elsewhere, is an extension from Srimati Radharani. And now it gets a little technical, but he's saying, as as she's, we can say, illuminating Krishna, she's revealing Krishna. One place Guru Maharaj says, faith is the halo of Radharani. So what does that mean in a practical sense? What is revealing Krishna, illuminating Krishna conception? And if we take this to it in a substantial way, we'll say necessarily service, not just data, the transfer of data or information. Krishna looks like, here's a Puranic description about what Krishna looks like. That will not, that may generate a mental image or an intellectual image, but the roop of Krishna, nama rupa guna lila, the actual roop of Krishna will come through sevan mukhe hijivado shayameva sportida, through a service connection. So seva mayoyam loka, sradha mayoyam loka, or sometimes synonymous. So through the cultivation of faith, and what does that mean? It's not like you say, yeah, I'm doing that. Right? Shraddhan Bhuta Anushranayat Atavarnayedya. It's something that descends from this plane. Like the famous Upanishadic sloka, Nayamatma Pravachanena Labhyo Namedaya Na Bahuna Sutena. Saying, you won't get this because you read a lot of books, you Googled, Bahuna Srutena, many, you've heard from many sources. So, Nayamatma Prabhachana Medayana, being very intelligent, Namedayana Bahuna Srutena, Tome Vaisha, Vrinute Tena Labhyas, Tashaisha Atma, Vivrinute Tanum Swam. He reveals himself to whom he chooses, through whom he chooses, and to what degree he chooses. So what will lead to that? Sevan mukata, by making one's approach through service, with a service attitude, infused with serving tendency, then there can be revelation. Without that, it's academic. You can get a superficial Krishna conception.
So in one place Guru Maharaj said that faith is the eye of the soul, the eye with which we can see God.
Yes, and so where do you get that eye? Agyana timarandasya gyananjana salakaya. You get it from Guru. Sadhu Shastra Guru Vaishnava. Shastra Chakshus, Sadhu Chakshus. Seeing through, they're extending the seeing. As we told the other day, Guru Maharaj is saying, you were extended the capacity to appreciate. That means, param drishtva nivartate. How will you have this superior experience? It's a matter of grace. So what was that article titled? Sri Guru and his grace. What is grace compared to? Guru Maharaj said, like sunshine. Just having an eye is not enough. You need light. Grace is the light by which the eye of the soul sees. So if you say that's faith, then where do you get that? Grace, Sri Guru and His grace. It's something descending. It's something being extended to one. The capacity to see, to appreciate. Otherwise we'll think that it's self-generated. Remember Guru Maharaj's famous example when Krishna is trying to starts with an E. I can't anyway. Krishna, he wants to make a diplomatic solution to the before the Battle of Kurukshetra. So in, where is it, the Kuru Sabha, he is at one point when a diplomatic negotiation breaks down, then it occurs the other side, well, Arjuna chose Krishna. If we just capture Krishna, they're finished. So they go to apprehend Krishna, and he expands himself into innumerable Krishnas, and then to innumerable, and they're not sure which one's the original, which one is a fake. But with Krishna, they don't have to. They can be real. Vilas Vigraha, Prakash, they're not fakes. It's not a yogi's trick. And then he's showing the Virat Rupa. Now they're not only bewildered; they're astonished. Viradavidusam tatvam brahm yoginam. And so, as it is in that time in the of Mahabharata, Greater India, even at these negotiations, there's so many sages there. Then they're seeing this Virat Rupa of Krishna, this universal form, like he showed Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita. As they say in Thailand, same, same, but different. So same, same, but different. Because he's fresh, ever fresh. He shows it in a new way. It's time. The sages start offering praise. And Dhritarashtra, who's the blind king, he's sitting on the throne, and he hears that this extraordinary, they're saying, oh Lord, your innumerable forms are so glorious and wonderful. And they're offering prayers, similar to those in the Bhagavad Gita, praising all these innumerable forms, avatars, manifestations being shown by Krishna. And this awakens the curiosity in Dhritarashtra to see this. It's driving him crazy. He's blind. Everyone else can see this, and I can't see it. Imagine that. I mean, if you ever wanted to see something. So he prays to Krishna. He said, oh, Krishna, you're so great. Actually, we all know that. This is a play. But if you would just remove my blindness momentarily so I can see what they're seeing, and then I'll go back to being blind again. But just for a moment, let me see what they're seeing. That's his plea, his prayer. And Guru Maharaj said, Krishna says to him, it's not necessary to remove your blindness. And this is the point. He said, that is not necessary. That's not Krishna consciousness. He said, if I say you will see, if I will that you will see this, you will see it. As a blind man, you'll see it. The physical blindness is not the impediment to your seeing this. It's whether I will that you see it, you'll see it. And Guru Maharaj said, and the blind man saw. That's what it is. Otherwise, we're told, what is the Bengali saying about owls in the presence of the sun? whose divine eyes are awakened, they see signs of divinity in everywhere and everything. But otherwise, if that divine eye is not awakened, then like an owl in the presence of the sun, they see nothing. So it's a gift, Sri Guru and His grace, the grace of Sri Guru, spiritual seeing, the extension of faith, which is our only means to approach that plane, as Guru Maharaj told. Doubt is a function of intelligence. So too much intellectual analysis creates doubt. Doubt disturbs faith, and faith is our only means of access to this plane. So we pray for Sri Guru and His grace. Hare Krishna.